Hello and welcome to this episode of the SCTS Education Podcast. Now, we hear an awful lot about the use of AI at the moment, but what does it actually take to develop an AI platform in healthcare and how can we start using it? Today, we have a look behind the curtain with consultant cardiologist and associate professor of cardiology at the University of Birmingham, Dr. Mark Thomas, who is also the co-founder of Medicate. And Medicate uses AI to combine the NICE guidelines for cardiovascular disease with all the medications you can think of in cardiovascular medicine. And this allows you to get recommendations for particular medical scenarios. It's currently being used as an upskilling educational tool and is available for health professionals to sign up. So you can always check it out at the website, which I'll put a link to in the show notes. In this chat, we talk about some of the challenges of implementing AI in healthcare and how Mark came about doing this and some of the long train journeys that helped contribute. I very much hope this gives you a little taster of where we might be looking to in the future. Welcome to the SCTS Education Podcast, and thank you very much for joining me, Mark. So today I'm joined by Mark Thomas, who is an Associate Professor of Cardiology from the University of Birmingham, and also a consultant in cardiology, and specifically in preventative cardiology, which I understand is, it's not a, you're one of a few. There are a select few consultants in preventative cardiology. Why do you think that is?
Well, I guess it doesn't really have a specific training program in the UK. So I guess I had to kind of cobble it together myself a bit during my training. So just doing some clinics in diabetes and lipid management and things like that, and kind of piece that together with some training in CT coronary angiography and things. But because it doesn't really exist as a formal thing, I guess, you end up kind of making it up a bit as you go along.
Well, absolutely. That sounds like I think it sounds like a sort of subspecialty that's just beginning. So not only are we going to go into this, your entrepreneurial journey, but not only an innovator in terms of the Medicate, the app we're going to talk about, but also in terms of your career path, because I wouldn't be surprised if that ends up being a specialty that maybe gathers momentum in the future. So not only are you an associate professor and consultant cardiologist, but you're also an NHS clinical entrepreneur. And in particular, you are the co-founder of an app called Medicate. And I'm just going to emphasize that Medicate is spelt with an AI, so Medicate. And you've described it as a sat-nav for complex prescribing. Do you want to expand a little bit more on that, what you're hoping that people are able to gain from Medicate?
Yeah, so basically prescribing's become really complicated now. So for example, after you've had a heart attack, depending on what different comorbidities you have, there's potentially up to 50 million recommended combinations of NICE recommended treatments now. So basically Medicate helps kind of guide people through what all of the different options are, what the most recommended options are, so that patients can ideally then get the right medications every time. Because at the moment, because of the complexity, they often miss out on some of the best ones. And they may also be on medications that they don't really need to be on and could be doing them harm as well. So identifying those ones and stopping those as well. So we plan to implement this at scale, and not just for acute coronary syndrome, so heart attacks, but also potentially there's over 1 billion people worldwide on medications now. So we could be optimizing all of those medications, making sure people are always on the right medications, and doing this all in real time to prevent millions of heart attacks and strokes and deaths across the world. So that's our kind of our large aim, and we're kind of starting off, like you say, through the NHS Clinical Entrepreneur Program, being a great start to working our way towards that large aim that we have.
Well, I think it's a very admirable aim, and it's so needed. When you said about there being 50 million different combinations of medications, I remember years ago when I was an SHO, I was asked by the anaesthetist to kind of consolidate all the different ways that we purely prescribed aspirin, clopidogrel, ticagrelor after coronary artery surgery. They were getting really sick of having different rules for different people. And they were like, we just need someone to organize it, do it. And I was like, yeah, this annoys me too. I can do this. I wrote it all down. And there were so many different combinations, depending on whether someone was post like an urgent CABG, or if they were an elective CABG, or who wanted 150 aspirin, who wanted 300 aspirin, who wanted it within 6 hours, who wanted it within 24 hours, and a huge variety even within that. And I remember showing it to one of the surgical consultants, who was like, that can't possibly be true. That was the words. And yet I knew it was. And that is just with a handful, like a tiny handful of the post-op medications we prescribe. So when you translate that across all the comorbidities, cardiovascularly related diseases that we see, and the ever-evolving amount of recommendations and evidence that comes up on a regular basis, like 50 million combinations is absolutely plausible.
Yeah, because I mean, even if you think about it, so just again, like with the patients you mentioned, the post-op ones, well, again, like if they've got AF, you mm-hmm. think about coagulants, and then you think about all the lipid drugs. I mean, now, say, you know, just in the last few years, we have things like PCSK9 inhibitors, ones you may not have even heard of, called like bempedoic acid, icosapent ethyl, you know, we have inclisiran. We have huge numbers of these different drugs. We have SGLT2 inhibitors, GLP-1 agonists, diabetes. And it's basically too much, isn't it, really, to kind of keep all of that all in your head and just kind of hope that you can pull it out at the right time.
Yeah. And the truth is that that we can't, or that we're very reliant on the wider team in order to do it. This is where the feasibility of staying up to date is challenging, and you want to be able to have something that's going to do some of the heavy lifting for you. And that is where Medicate comes in. So what can people do when they log on to Medicate, or when they look at the website?
So basically, at the moment, we have an educational version of it. So people can go on there. And the idea is that we're upskilling nurses and pharmacist prescribers, and also GPs and trainee doctors as well, in prescribing, particularly in the context of cardiovascular disease and multimorbidity. But we have a very wide range of different guidelines on there now. So we have over 50 different guidelines from NICE, and so different guidelines and technology appraisals. And that covers things like diabetes, coronary artery disease, CKD, hypertension, obesity, you know, a very wide range of chronic diseases. And then basically you can put in different clinical features. So it uses AI. So AI will kind of guide you through what the most relevant clinical features are. So if, say, you put in acute coronary syndrome, it might then ask you what type of acute coronary syndrome. And then it'll ask around 10 questions or so to clarify the recommended medications are based on those different clinical features. So for groups of patients that have those clinical features, it'll say what the recommended treatments are. So we've got that set up for educational purposes at the moment, so for training. And then we're working on using the same technology as well to develop that. So it could be used as a clinical tool in the future as well. So it could be used directly in clinical practice then as well. We're aiming to integrate that into the electronic healthcare record.
That's excellent. That's excellent news. And you can, when you go on it, you can do all sorts of things, like combinations of different sorts of comorbidities that people have, and you can really play around with what sort of medications are recommended. And it's almost like a traffic light system. So it's very easy to interpret. And then when you're clicking on it, it will then give you a link to the NICE recommendations, but also a really nice little summary of why is or isn't recommended. So you don't have to go to the NICE recommendations and read through everything. You've actually got quite a neat little explanation. So yeah, I think it's very helpful. You might look and think, yeah, actually, this is exactly what I thought. But then there might be these other ones that, yeah, you haven't heard of. Then you can at least know what you don't know, and where you can then ask advice from somebody else. You were talking about AI, and you've done an awful lot of work in AI, as well as your extensive cardiology background. You're also an AI software engineer. So first of all, how did that come about?
So I had some very long train journeys. So I had about 2.5 hours a day on a train for 3 years during my PhD. So I guess it got to the point where I got bored of the little Netflix buffering symbol. So I I started basically doing pretty much back-to-back courses in computer science. So I did ones initially from MIT, which are really good, like these sort of online courses you can do. And then some ones in machine learning and big data and things like that. So that was all mostly Stanford and Johns Hopkins for those ones. So it's, I mean, it's amazing what you can kind of get access to, like how good quality education you can get online. So I did about 1,000 hours in total. It's, I mean, it's fair to say I got slightly obsessed by it. And I suppose I'd always wanted to learn to program at some point. I thought it's like, I guess it just appeared. I've always loved tech stuff. So, yeah, so kind of learned then, and then slightly disappointed I didn't manage to make much use of it for a few years, actually. Still kept an interest. And then it basically came to literally pretty much being sat in clinic and thinking, like, this is quite algorithmic, what I'm doing. You know, like you with you drawing out all of the different pathways for anti-platelet medications and things, it all feels very algorithmic. And you think, oh, this would be quite easy to just write a bit of code that will just sort this out. And, you know, if the blood pressure is over 130 or whatever, start this. And it turned out it's actually really complicated. So definitely not the few hundred lines of code I initially thought it would be. And I guess kind of developed skills from that. So I guess when you have a really hard project in front of you, you have to learn to develop the skills to be able to kind of solve that project. So I basically massively underestimated how many different thought processes you go through when you're working out how to prescribe something. You know, it's huge numbers of different things you have to think about. And all these things that we kind of take for granted, like, don't know, little things like it might say if the LDL cholesterol is over 2.6 or something like that. But then you realize you have to know which LDL cholesterol, and you know, it's all these like little hidden things. Is that after the statin started or before the statin started? And we can kind of just answer them as we go along, but obviously you have to program all these things. So yeah, very complicated project. But basically because of that, I had to learn a lot more about actual software architecture as well, because we now have dozens of different modules that do various different things to actually kind of do all of the logic behind what it does. So it looks very simple, but there's, like most things, I guess, a lot of things that look very simple. To make it look simple is really complicated. So yeah, there's lots of modules behind it, and I had to learn a lot about software architecture to actually kind of manage all of the complexity of that. Then I joined up with James Dimmock. He's a professional software engineer, and so he's got experience of leading teams of software engineers and kind of working on products that have scaled to millions of people. But he also, very unusually, is a full-stack software developer himself and is sort of highly skilled. So he can manage sort of very wide variety of different tasks and different projects. So he's been great to work with. I've learned a lot from working with him. And I guess it's quite good because we can both push each other a bit in different areas. Like, you know, certain things, well, a lot of things he's a lot better than I am at. And but then there's other things, actually, like working with AI, where it turns out actually having this sort of deep domain expertise is really useful, particularly working with, so we work with like OpenAI, GPT-4 and Claude 3 Opus, which are some of the kind of cutting edge large language models. So basically like the current AI, so like the stuff that powers ChatGPT and things like that. And it's really useful having deep domain expertise, because when it comes out with an answer, I can kind of immediately tell if that's the right answer or not. And then I can tweak what's called prompt engineering. So we kind of tweak the prompts or the text that we send to the large language model to then get a different response back. But I can kind of tweak it in real time because I can see, oh, it's not quite picked up on what I meant there. So I can tweak the prompt that we send, and then we get a better one back next time. And I can just kind of iterate and get it better and better. But without domain expertise, that's kind of impossible at the moment.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting, because whatever comes out is really based on what goes in. I think when you say, like, you go in thinking, this is just a few algorithms, it'll be fine, And then finding out it's a lot more complex. I think it's one of those things that sometimes when you, it's good to not know these things when you start.
Definitely. I think, and actually it's a well-recognized thing in a way, actually. Now I've learned a lot more about startups. Is this sort of beginner's mindset, or you kind of need the naivety sometimes to do like radically new things? Because if I knew now how complicated this project was going to be, there's no way I would have started it, because it would have looked insurmountable. And I guess a sensible person would have looked at it and said, like, that's too difficult. But because you sort of go into it optimistically thinking it'll be easy, and then having, I guess, that combined with the stubbornness to actually persist and like make it work. Yeah, I think. But it does seem to be a common sort of entrepreneurial thing almost, of like sometimes some of the innovations come from people who have not worked a huge amount in that area before, and they sort of don't know all of the reasons why it should be impossible to do what they're doing.
Definitely. And I think also, I don't know, I kind of think if this and this and this is possible, we should be able to do this. And then, you know, you find the people you need to along the way who can help you make it happen. In terms of the AI models, when we hear about things like ChatGPT, it's sometimes described a bit as a black box. So you don't actually absolutely know what's going on behind the algorithm generation, and therefore you can't be absolutely certain what's coming out. How do you manage that sort of thing when you're organizing or working out prompts and working out what you're aiming to get out of it?
Yeah, I mean, that's a like really critical point, because I mean, like you say, it's completely a black box, and it's also an unpredictable black box as well. So I guess to summarize, a huge amount of work with prompt engineering is even using a lot of the latest techniques or the recommended techniques. So basically using, you can put examples in. So if you send a prompt to AI, but you give it some examples of, this is how I would like your answers to look, and you say, you know, you give it some examples of, this is the input and then this is the output I would like, and you kind of give it maybe five examples or more even, then it performs a lot better if you do that. There's other stuff. So if you tell it to like go through step by step or things along those lines, then, I mean, it's fascinating that these things actually make it perform better. So it will kind of do it better if you tell it to go step by step. And then there's also kind of bizarre stuff as well. So DeepMind published a paper where one of the findings in that was basically if you tell it to take a deep breath, it performs better as well, which is it's kind of odd how it almost gives it like a human feel to it, doesn't it? But it's obviously just learned that from you know, the internet, and I guess nobody fully understands why taking a deep breath makes it perform better, but maybe because people who write that on the internet tend to then write sensible stuff afterwards. It's difficult to know, but anyway, with doing all of this kind of prompt engineering, we've tried all of the kind of recommended techniques for these sorts of things. You can kind of make it give a very impressive answer, like 95% of the time for clinical stuff. So even quite difficult, complex clinical stuff, you can get a very impressive answer like 95% of the time, where you can give it like quite random situations, and it's genuinely impressive that you do feel there's some real actual intelligence there. But the downside is it gets it wrong, like even with significant, you know, good prompt engineering, gets it wrong maybe at least 2 to 5% of the time, which is just not okay in clinical practice. So our approach is, any use of AI that we use at the moment is all kind of expert in the loop AI. So AI generates some stuff, and then it always has to be in a format that I can then check it afterwards, or that other domain experts can check it afterwards. We don't have any kind of use of AI at the moment that's not checked by an expert. And I think particularly in clinical settings, I think personally, you know, these things are incredibly difficult to predict, but I think we're at least a few years away from being able to directly kind of follow the output of AI without any human intervention. But still, this can still be very useful, even though you can't directly do what it says, because you can kind of check the output and then potentially you know, with say converting guidelines into kind of logic that runs Medicaid, it's allowed me to probably process five times more guidelines using AI because I can check the output. So yeah, it does work well.
I think with AI, the idea that you have a system where you're able to moderate it, in like that, as you were saying, the domain expertise that then goes into being able to moderate it, and then it becomes a useful tool for people to be able to condense the vast amount of information that we have at our fingertips now. And the problem is that although we have the information, we don't have it at our fingertips. We might feel like we do, because we could type something in, like say a medication I've not heard of before. I could type it in if someone's told me it, and I could find it in the BNF. But that's not the same as knowing how to apply it. So I think what you're able to do, you're able to allow people to actually have that information in a useful format at their fingertips, so they can apply it in a sensible way. Because otherwise, I think one of the challenges that we've all got is just the huge volume. And to keep up with that, that's where some of this sort of technology can come in really helpful.
Yeah, I mean, like with guidelines particularly, I guess like 10 years or so ago, everybody used to criticize guidelines and they'd say, oh, well, you know, I can't really follow this guideline because my patient is, you know, they're elderly and they got CKD or something, so it doesn't apply. I'll do what I want, which, you know, fair enough. Now we have kind of the opposite problem where actually the guidelines now, they probably do say what to do if you're elderly. They probably do say what to do if you've got CKD and things, particularly some of, say, the European Society of Cardiology guidelines, which are very detailed and have cover so many different possible cases now, where they cover like over 95% of patients that we see. There it is explained in the guidelines exactly what you should do, but we have the downside now that that means it's like a 200 page document. So like, you know, we can't really use 200 page documents in real time in clinical practice, I guess. So yeah, and it's the sort of thing, obviously computers are ideal for kind of going through very algorithmic stuff like this, but yeah, I guess it's all of the, well, I guess there's a lot of reasons why it's never existed so far. I now kind of understand all of the different difficulties involved and have had to kind of think very deeply about each of them to kind of think of a way past them. It's definitely, we definitely need better approaches to dealing with all of this complexity. And it's only going to get more complicated as well. When you think like whole genome sequencing and things like that, you know, if you want to start using that in your clinical decision making, then clearly like, you need to have computers involved in implementing that. No, nobody can kind of start looking at using these kind of very big data sets to influence clinical practice until we have computers kind of automatically assisting us at the same time. Yeah, big problem.
Yeah, but and that's the sort of the phrase, I guess, is like assisted decision making, isn't it? To kind of assist the decisions rather than anything else. And the other thing that I think is interesting is that we've kind of got two steps. When you're making guidelines, there's sort of a series of steps. There's a kind of consolidating all the actual evidence from directly from the papers, and then it's then putting the recommendations, consolidating that, from what I understand, that at the moment it's a case of going from the 200 page document of recommendations into the app, rather than from the original evidence as such and the statistical weighting and all that kind of thing. It's it's not, and I wonder in the future, like, it's probably not in the future, there's probably someone doing it now. You're probably doing it now, but like, you know, like almost like a form of meta-analysis, but you know, getting all the statistical weighting in there. Because the other thing that I always find interesting is how another set of guidelines come up and there'll always be an opinion of like, oh well, this was heavily weighted towards the cardiology opinion, or oh, this was heavily weighted towards the surgical opinion. And I kind of think, well, wouldn't it be nice if we could assess that data so that there wasn't that perceived bias whether or not it's true or not. But one of the things that I understand when I was looking at some of the nice stuff about this is the challenges of going from the narrative text that you have into making it a sort of technical language that you can then plug into these algorithms. Is that something that you've been involved in doing, or is that something that is, you kind of, it's already in a nicely packaged way that you're able to use it?
Yeah, so that's a difficult issue. So I've been working with NICE partly in kind of helping to work out ways to digitize guidelines, because one big problem, like you say, is that obviously guidelines are written in free text, and you do find, you might notice if you look at NICE, they are kind of semi-structured, like that some of the language they use and the kind of structuring of the sentences and things, it is very specific, and like you can tell that they clearly thought about trying to cover various different possible interpretations and things, and they try to be very specific, actually, the NICE ones, and try to be unambiguous, I guess. But yeah, at the moment there's not really an established format for how you make that interpretable by a computer. So there've been kind of lots of attempts at that over the last, you know, 20, 30, 40 plus years, but no defined sort of standard for how you kind of write that logic in a very clear, unambiguous way that can be interpreted by a computer. And I think some of the biggest problems with ways that have been attempted to do that are that they're not really human readable. So I think it's really important that all of this stuff is human readable. So kind of we put a big effort into making sure that everything we do is kind of human readable, human interpretable, so that it can all be kind of checked, it can be peer reviewed. But people before us have not really valued that as highly. They've kind of gone down a much more technical route of kind of defining these things almost in a very sort of mathematical or programming language sort of way that then a cardiologist wouldn't be able to read it or understand it. But I guess maybe because we've come at it from a kind of clinician angle, that readability and interpretability and peer review sort of possibility is kind of critical, I guess, to all of this.
And so how are you starting to integrate into clinical practice? Because I think you said this is me stealing from your big pitch, which is excellent, that you've got some cardiac rehab nurses that are going to start using the program.
Yeah, so no, we're really excited by that, actually. So that's very recent. And so it was just a few weeks ago, actually, where we had our first meeting with the Midlands Cardiac Network, so it's part of NHS England, the cardiac rehab nurses, so in their steering committee meeting, presented all of this to them. And actually, it was really nice to see how genuinely excited they were to see it, because cardiac rehab nurses do a lot around medications. You know, they review kind of the beta blockers, the ACE inhibitors, the statins, they try and make sure they're on the right lipid lowering drugs and things like that. And you could see that they could kind of immediately see the benefit of this sort of stuff, and that it could genuinely empower them to be able to do more. So at the moment, we've got funding to use it to train them up. So we can help to, you know, run through different possible scenarios, and they can see what the different recommended treatments were. They can see what the NICE recommendations for those would be. They can see even for complex things, what would the right treatments be? And then they can use that then later in their clinical practice. You know, we kind of teach them, and then they can use what we've taught afterwards. And then also arranging teaching sessions with them as well. So to kind of upskill them in complex multimorbidity prescribing. A lot of them now have started doing independent prescribing as well, and have done the prescribing courses and things. So I think I have to say nurse prescribers in particular are quite excited to be able to make more use of that prescribing qualification. Because I guess on the one hand, you know, some people end up just using that so that they can, you know, somebody says on a ward round to start aspirin, and then they can start the aspirin. But on the other end, what we want to sort of achieve is that actually they're kind of fully upskilled and empowered to be doing even like very complicated, interesting stuff themselves, that with the combination of what they learn over time and kind of developing their own experience and expertise, but also being kind of boosted by software, and kind of also a bit of a safety net with software as well, potentially, where it can flag up that, you know, you shouldn't do this as well, and that these things are not recommended. So it could give them a little bit more confidence in the future once we get to the stage where, so this is later on down the lines, we could develop it as a medical device, so it's actually they can use it at the point of care as well, which is not what we have planned at the moment. but is kind of the next thing that we're working towards.
It struck me that particularly on the wards, all the AMPs go through their prescribing training at some stage, and it's sometimes a struggle to get the right sort of supervision or direction, depending on what sort of workplace they're working in. And when I looked at this, I just thought, well, this is what all the AMPs will want when they're doing that, or anybody who's doing a prescribing course, because it just helps to really clarify things. And I suspect they'll be so empowered by it, but they might be asking a few awkward questions to people on the ward rounds. But isn't that the purpose? I mean, isn't the purpose to be making sure that every patient gets the right medication, that they're optimized in every setting? You're saying that it can make a real mortality difference. It can make certainly a morbidity difference and prevent rehospitalization. And if we've already got the data that shows that these are the improvements that can be made for people, it's just a question of having the right tool to be able to put it in place. That's what it is. It's using what there already is in the most efficient and effective fashion. What's also reassuring is what's being done by people like NICE and also the WHO in getting the sort of narrative written data ready to go into devices and the kind of objectives. I could see NICE had written something down about making sure it was all traceable, that it was high fidelity, it was consistent. So I think, and all actually, like, all this is fairly recent. I think these were all sort of 2022 publications, which, but it's clear that there is thought going into all of this as to how best to consolidate data so it can be used in a responsible way, which I think is quite reassuring.
Yeah. I mean, I have to say, I've been very impressed with kind of NICE's approach to all of this, and also how much they prioritise it as well. Actually, they kind of see this as an important area, and the fact that they can kind of see the impact it could have on patient care in the future, and also seeing that, they recognise that their guidelines are not necessarily used as much as they would like them to be. They see that some of the recommendations are not followed and things like that. And obviously they're keen that any of the recommendations that they've made, are followed, or that, to be honest, another useful thing is to flag up if ones are not being followed, like what are the reasons for that? Like, is it because clinicians have concerns about that recommendation, that actually clinicians don't think that's a good recommendation, and some sort of system? So kind of definitely something we're keen to help work on is a way of feeding back that clinicians don't like these recommendations, these specific ones, and they like these recommendations instead. And that's all very useful information that at the moment there's no real way that's captured routinely. So yeah, that could all again help to improve patient care in the long run.
Yeah, the subtle things that have stopped people from making that prescribing decision, whether it's a past experience or even something as simple as it's actually quite difficult to get hold of, and you have to speak to this person to get it prescribed, sometimes these can be process issues, maybe even more than kind of side effect profiles and things like that.
And also one sort of other thing to mention really is that another kind of important thing in all of decision making around treatments, and something that we kind of just started to build in but really hasn't been focused on enough in other things like this, is, I guess, we've talked about the guideline creators, we've talked about clinicians and things, but obviously, like, patient choice is a massive issue as well. Clearly patients should be fully involved in all of the decision making related to their treatments, and a lot of these more automated approach actually could really help with that, because you could kind of more automatically provide them with information about the medications, because none of us have to hand like a patient information leaflet about antiplatelet drugs or something, whereas actually if you could just automatically provide that to the patient, maybe as an email or however they want it, as a PDF and things, and that's just sent to them automatically. Again, like, taking into account if they're intolerant of different medications. So we've included that, but also because of the way we kind of structured everything, in the same way that we can take into account guideline recommendations, we can also use a similar sort of logic to take into account patient preferences in a way. So something in the future definitely very keen to implement is a way to encode patient preferences into the actual electronic healthcare record as well, because we don't really do that at all at the moment. And then to actually use that in decision making as well. But that's a really complicated area, but is completely overlooked at the moment. So yeah, an important area to work on.
Yeah, I mean, there are so many powerful opportunities to intervene there. This is the way that AI can really be used to kind of empower people with the decision making. And I think it's really interesting to hear from you what goes into actually using it. It's not so much pressing a button as an awful lot of other processes that go into the regulation of it. And that's what is the difference between having something that is maybe a ChatGPT on its own putting a question into something which actually has kind of a level of authority associated with it, something that you can then trust and have a stamp of, you know, this is something which has some quality assurance. And I think that's probably going to be key as we move forward, is to know what information you can go, oh yes, do you know what, this is validated, and therefore I can trust what I'm dealing with here. So I think that's really valuable. One last very important thing, which is, where can people find Medicaid? The website, all the details about it. I mean, I will put a link to it. I'll make sure there's a link to it as well in the notes.
But... So, yeah, as you say, it's medicaid.com. So that's with AITE at the end. So, yeah, people can go on there. There's a free subscription for 1 month. And then we have, at the moment, still our early adopter price.
Get in while you can.
£2.95, yeah. We won't offer that forever. And then Medicaid will help to kind of upskill you in various different aspects of prescribing so you can become a super prescriber.
Are you thinking of going into other areas other than cardiovascular pharmacology? I'm thinking this is, because this is obviously an area you could just expand in.
Yeah. So we have over 50 NICE guidelines on there at the moment. So covering things like, they're mostly cardiovascular-ish. So like as in diabetes obviously has cardiovascular links and things like that, CKD, hypertension, obesity, mostly just because I have a lot of clinical expertise with those areas, so I can also assess the output. But ultimately, yeah, it could be any medications. It's definitely not linked to cardiovascular. So yeah. And if anybody's interested in this area or would kind of like to learn more, they're definitely welcome to get in touch with me as well.
Excellent. Okay, well, thank you so much for joining me. And yeah, well done on the whole venture. I think it's great. And I wish you all the best with it.
Well, big thank you again to Dr. Mark Thomas for joining me in this episode. And thank you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I did. Again, if you want to contact us, give us any feedback, that'd be fantastic. The email is sctseducationpodcast@gmail.com. And we're also on Twitter, or X, formerly known as Twitter, which is @podcast_scts. The Medicaid website is www.medicaid, which is spelled medicaite.com. And I will make sure there is a link in the description box as well. Definitely worth taking a look. And yeah, see what you agree with, and see how many medications you can predict. Anyway, thanks again and see you next time. Bye.